not hurt you. But doesn't everybody agree?
We can phrase it differently, intent's the same. I'd like to welcome everybody here today. Let's go ahead and get started. If everybody can look over the minutes from last meeting, take a look.
So I make a motion to adopt the minutes.
Craig has made a motion to adopt the minutes. Craig seconds the motion. All in favor? All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Next, I don't believe we have anything that requires an executive session. Is that correct, Kat?
That is correct.
Okay, let's move down to the licensing report for January through March. Kathy?
Right. Included in your packet is the January and February. I just barely gave out the March report. We've had a change in our DTS information, so that's why the March report wasn't ready until today. Basically, it's very consistent. The new licenses that have come in, any that were up for license renewal, and any that lapsed licenses that lapsed in that particular month, and any that was reinstated. Again, paying particular close scrutiny to the reinstated licenses. If that person belongs to your agency, you need to make sure that the association is actually put in place. Okay? Any questions on any of those? What we've got is a summary report for January, February, and March. So if you look over the information, the first page is the complaints, how many were open, how many were closed, how many calendar year to date. There are two audits. I know it talks about me discussing audits a little bit further. I'm in the process of finishing two of the audits that I've started. Once those are completed, then I'll be sending out the letters for the next two.
On average, how long does it take to complete an audit?
It's taking a little longer this time than it should, but on average, it's probably about 3 to 4 weeks per audit.
And I would assume most of that is on the back end, or?
Yes, it is. I have to give 2 weeks' notice, usually, that I'm coming out. And then, you know, give the information, or if they're coming into the office, bringing the information that's required. Sometimes what happens is we have to reschedule dates as far as when the audit actually is initiated. And then once I receive all the information, then there's a lot, there can be a lot of back and forth to clarify or to get more information as it's needed.
Thank you, Kat.
All right. The second page is the open investigations, and that's open within the last 90 days. And so it does have the open business close date, so if they still have showed up, we are currently working on them.
So the 65052, that's a personal judgment, not a bail bond judgment.
Correct.
That's like a agent.
Yes, it's what happens is everybody is subject to 31A-23A, which is governs the producers and agencies. So not only are you under the authority of 31A-35, which is the bail bond, but you're also under that other chapter.
And that one's still open?
That's fine.
It is.
So they didn't pay it within 60 days, and then the complaint was filed on the 2nd, and then
yes.
It's still open?
Yes.
And they have not paid to this date?
I can't talk about that particular open investigation at this moment in time, but at the time that this particular report was run, it still hadn't been paid. And then, any more questions on that particular? The cases?
One on the failure to file forms, I don't know what detail you can speak, but is that new forms that never got approved or a change that was made on a form?
It can be either. It can be that new forms have been used and they just were not approved. It can be that an address change happened and they were just not approved. So, it addresses the fact that whatever happened, those particular forms in our file are overlaid with the property casualty division.
I thought it was real nice the last meeting when we had Kathy and Tracy come and
Kathy
talk to
and,
us.
Kathy and Chris.
And Chris, excuse me, come yes. and talk to us about,
yes.
about the forms. I think that clarified things.
It helps
quite
them
a bit.
A lot, yes. Absolutely. And then the last stage on at least that part of it is the enforcement cases. So currently there are two open cases within the last 90 days that are at the attorney's office, or with the attorney. Okay? Oh, I apologize. The number of days opened, I did not get that part filled out.
Failure to respond is, they're not responding to you, or I don't understand what failure to respond
would be that I've requested some information under the authority of the commissioner, and they haven't responded in the appropriate amount of time. And then the last part of that is just the cases since 2015, which is just kind of an overview that we had talked about before, whether they've had other cases and or other cases and what the indicators were there.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
So, Kathy, it appears that these are the same unpaid judgments to courts.
Mm-hmm.
Unpaid judgment to courts is the current reason, and that looks consistent with their prior action explanation. Are these repeat offenders? Are they different?
Most of them are repeat offenders. Once in a while you have somebody that hasn't shown up for a while and then... Yeah, they all are. On this particular list, yes.
And they were all eventually paid, but just
yes.
not.
Yeah, typically speaking.
Not timely.
Yeah, to the court, and so then they sent me over the forfeiture judgment and the packet, and then I sent out a forfeiture letter and given 5 days to pay to the courts.
Is there any action taken, penalty?
If they get it done within the time frame that they're supposed to, then I close our case. I have not had one that's gone over the time. If you look at the other report, it'll say something like 8 days because it's 5 working days. And if I get a report or the request from the court at the very end of the day, then I'm starting the next day on accounting.
And I believe later on in the agenda, you're going to talk about the process.
Yes,
I explain some of these things.
Yes.
Really clear.
Absolutely. And I did address the fact that I'm actually in the process of finishing 2 audits and we'll be continuing on with the audit process. Okay. So now we're getting to the part where actually Gary is going to be helping Gary Josephson. So I'm going to start out and talk about the investigations and what happens on my end with an investigation or complaint. And then once I finish that part, Gary will talk about due process and the cases when they go to the attorney. Okay.
I notice on here it says Kathy and Perry. That was meant to be Kathy and Gary.
It's rhyming, so we go with that.
As long as it's close, we'll never notice it.
Right. Okay. When I get them, there are actually two investigations that I get. They can be generated from complaints, or they can come as an investigation, choosing. If it's a complaint, or even an investigation, a lot of times I have to contact the person or the entity where the complaint started to get a little more information or a little more background information as to why they opened the complaint. So sometimes there's the process of contacting them to get that information, and I have to give them a few days or to get that to me before I can actually proceed with a complaint or an investigation. Once I've got the information from the source, then I'm actually researching out to see if there's any code violations or possible rule violations that do apply to that particular situation. So it's not only the Bell codes that I'm looking at, but it's also the codes regarding the producer to see if there's anything in either code that does relate to either the complaint or the investigation. Once I do that, I prepare a letter to the respondent or the person that we're looking at, requesting their information and indicating that there's a case that's been opened, and this is the information that I've got. Could they respond or give their further information? So if it's a forfeiture, let's say it's an investigation with a forfeiture judgment from the court, they have 5 working days to pay that forfeiture judgment at the court. Otherwise, there is the suspension of the license, et cetera, as we've already talked about. But if it's another type of an investigation, I have to give them 10 working days, which then you have to also include weekends that go into that to respond to my request for information. Sometimes what happens with that is any documentation I have, I'm giving them time to reply, but they may have to take a little bit of time, or it might take them a little longer to get that information to me. And so with that, there is the interaction, and the initial information may take a little longer to get to me.
On an unpaid judgment, you give them those 5 days. If it is not paid, is the suspension immediate?
Then I begin the process for the suspension and send the information to our attorney so that we can go ahead and get the license suspended for those.
So after that 5 days, if it's not paid, you start the process. How long is that process until the suspension is complete?
I have not actually had to do one yet. So I haven't researched out that entire part of it.
That's good.
Yeah, it actually is. Okay, so sometimes what happens with a case, if an investigation is involving a court case, whatever is happening at the court can actually stop my investigation for a short period of time, or a little longer if there's a motion to let's say there's a judgment, so there's a motion to set aside the judgment. That actually stops any of my abilities until that motion has actually been adjudicated through the court system. So I can't go further on it if it's, say it's a personal judgment, until that's been adjudicated. So that can stop it until the court has finished their part of it. There are times when a complaint is actually closed because it's a contractual violation rather than a code violation, and the complainant is informed at that time if they want to pursue the matter, they can do that. They're going to have to do that at the court and take the steps necessary to have it seen at court that it didn't meet a rules violation or a code violation, so we are closing our investigation of that particular complaint, and that does happen. once we receive all the paperwork, then the case is reviewed to determine what the next step is. And if the investigation does support some type of administrative action, a letter of recommendation is sent out to the respondent. And the letter of recommendation does give the respondent a couple of different options. If the respondent feels that there's additional information that wasn't included in the original documents that they sent or at that time, then they can go ahead and present more information, and then we would review that to see if it has any bearing on what we're recommending. The respondent can agree to stipulation and order at that time, and if there's a forfeiture amount, then it's also included in the letter of recommendation. Or the respondent can actually request a hearing. They're not going to go ahead and stipulate. They don't feel that this is warranted, so they're requesting a hearing for their side to be presented an administrative law hearing. So if they request if they request me to go ahead and look at more of the information, I do that, and then there is some negotiation if it's applicable or not. If it's a stipulation and order and they agree to it, then I prepare the case and I send it up to the attorney to prepare the stipulation and order. If they want a hearing, then I have to prepare the paperwork to send it to the attorney so that the attorney can prepare the hearing or the complaint. So that's what I do, at least on an investigation.
As far as what we do in our office, in the Attorney General's office, I think it's probably good to just start with the point that in a regulated industry like bail bonds, it's not uncommon to have the idea, whether I'm a member of a board or a commission or a commissioner, that bad acts should be taken care of right now. But if it's not done, there's something wrong. Why does it take so long? And why can't it just be immediately license taken or some type of immediate action? And the answer is due process. If you look at the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, it has to deal with federal actions. If you look at the 14th Amendment, it's the exact same wording, it has to do with state actions. And it basically says that no person will be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And the reason that's important in a regulated industry is that an insurance license is considered a property interest. So once I have acquired a license, and then you bring an action to take some type of action on my license, then you're required to follow due process of law. And a good example of that, or an example of that, is not too many years ago, the insurance department was sued because within 2 days they had revoked the license of an individual who hadn't been given any due process. The department just felt that this was so clear and such a violated action that it was, so they just took the license and then faced a lawsuit. And so I think it's important to emphasize and reiterate that in any type of regulatory industry, there's due process by the Constitution that has to be followed. And that due process just basically follows the lines of that I'm entitled to be notified of alleged violations, to be able to know and understand the violations, that two, I'm entitled to face the evidence, to hear the witnesses, or to see the written documentation. Third, that I have a right to be heard. And then fourth, that there's a decision made and a basis for that decision and the regulatory action. So that's why we have what's called the Utah Administrative Procedures Act, which mandates certain procedures be followed to take any type of administrative action. And that can be done in two forms, a formal proceeding or an informal proceeding. informal proceeding is just that, more informal, less restrictions and requirements to be complied with, a formal action being just that, more formal, in fact, more time, with the time to file an answer as to the respondent, and then a pre-hearing conference where preliminary matters are taken care of and any discovery identified that needs to be handled. And so that is also set before the actual hearing. And then, of course, there's under the Administration Act, there's also requirements as to what type of evidence can be presented, any type of restrictions or, you know, allowances that differ from Utah Rules of Civil Procedure as to district court requirements. There are some differences, but I'm impressed with Utah's Administrative Procedures Act in how it's written and how it's applied, and also, for the most part, the Insurance Department's additional regulations that relate to procedures. The bottom line is that the due process in a regulatory industry takes time, and that it's not something that any board, any commission, any commissioner or board president would want to just recklessly move ahead with and then face you know, a lawsuit or other actions. It really needs to be measured and the process followed, and in most all cases the truth comes out, and right decision is followed administratively. Are there any questions at all?
I appreciate the explanation and get everybody a better understanding of how and why things work. Sometimes we question why things work, but when that comes right down to it, we appreciate the process and realize that one day we might be on the other side and look at it a little different. So.
You know, I might just mention, I just forgot to mention one thing. There is a provision in the UAPA for an emergency proceeding, so it doesn't completely jump over that, but what it requires is to have an emergency type of proceeding for any government agency, it requires an immediate and significant danger to the public's health, safety, and welfare. So the you know, the hurdles to cross over are pretty high. And again, it just goes to the point that unless it's an industry that is involved with health and safety, maybe an argument can be made in particular cases as to the financial welfare, you know, of the public, but it's a high standard to meet as to supporting an emergency procedure with the administrative act.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Kathy. Does anybody have any questions on the process? Brett, would you talk to us about your committee update?
Yes. Well, first of all, it's not my committee.
Your experience.
I was hoping Gary would be here today because Gary attended with me the pretrial release practices and alternatives working group, which is one of the areas set for the Judicial Council to study this year. Gary and I attended the first meeting of the council about 3 weeks ago at the courthouse down the street here. The committee, the charges of the committee is to conduct a thorough assessment of existing pretrial release practices used in the Utah courts and determine if there are alternatives that should be considered. Specifically, the committee should, one, determine what constitutes a best practices in the field of pretrial release. We're to conduct an inventory of current practices and their effectiveness and their consistency, determine how to best improve the information needed by judges when making the decisions of whether or not to release a defendant charged before his court date, his or her court date, we're charged with reviewing the statutory history of release and bail legislation, and then evaluate alternatives in terms of best public protection, integrity of the court process, the ability to guard against punishment prior to conviction, and to be mindful of resource and costs and savings potentials for the jail system. So at the first meeting, the meeting was only scheduled for about 2 hours, and I had to leave about 2 hours and 15 minutes into the meeting, I wasn't there for the bitter end. But for the first hour or so, they talked about a survey that had been sent out to judges in various districts, various courts, various counties, and the judges provided feedback on what they do. And really, the results of that are as wide, I mean, they really run the spectrum. We talked about that for a little bit. We talked a great deal, or there was a lot of input about what Salt Lake County does, because apparently Salt Lake County has, compared to other counties and other court systems, has a fairly robust pretrial release program, and the judges are given more information in that program than judges get that are part of other systems. And then we had a presentation from a professor at the University of Utah, and she basically did a slideshow, a PowerPoint presentation, and highlighted the American Bar Association's best practices for pretrial release programs. Bail was mentioned extensively. Bail was not mentioned always in a really positive light. Gary and I were quick to point out at the end of her presentation and some of the examples that she gave. For instance, a defendant waiting in court for a considerable amount of time before his girlfriend could post a $400 bail on a $1,000 bond. Gary and I pointed out that would be illegal in Utah. We pointed out the requirements in Utah that the bail cannot be less than 10%. No more than 20% of the bail bond amount. One of the judges had some questions as to why we have that floor of 10%, can't charge less than 10%. I responded that based on the information I was aware of, that we didn't want to create a race to the bottom, and that is that people in the bail business bailing people out for the less than the cost of doing business, and then not being able to fulfill a default judgment or judgment in the event that the defendant didn't show up. The next meeting is that they've sent out a calendar thing. It'll be sometime in May. The first date is May 8th. The last date is like May 28th. So we have not gotten an update as to when the next meeting is. At the next meeting, the Department of Insurance will be presenting, with the help of the Attorney General's offices, law clerks, a brief overview or statutory history of release and specifically bail legislation, specifically in Utah, and then generally speaking, to give the panel or to give the committee kind of some background for the reasons why we have what we have today in Utah law. The membership of the committee is really a diverse group. There are a couple of district court judges, a juvenile court judge, two justice court judges, one prosecutor. Sam Gill was there. There's a defense attorney, a sheriff, there's a member of the Senate, which is Lyle Hilliard, a member of the Utah House, which is
Hutchings,
the representative that ran the bail bill this year, county government commercial bail agent, which is Gary Walton, and then an insurance commission representative, which is myself. What will come out of the committee is that we're to complete our work and our findings and make a recommendation to the Judicial Council at its November 2015 Judicial Council meeting. And that will allow the Judicial Council time to consider whether they want to propose legislation, and if so, what legislation they would propose.
And that would be presented in November of this year.
Yes, that's when, yeah, that's when the recommendation is due, is to the Judicial Council, whenever they meet in November of this year. And then I guess it's anticipated that they, if they determine that they, that the legislation is warranted, that that legislation would be advanced in next, the next, next legislative cycle.
Okay, I have a question. This might not be for you, but it might be for the Attorney General. Is your name Gary?
Gary Jesus.
What is it?
Yes.
I have a question. It's for Brad, but it would be more deferred to you. Okay, we're in a public meeting right now, and we're required to have this open to the public. Why is this meeting closed to the public?
I have no idea.
Yeah, that's a, I think that's a valid question, and I don't know, I didn't get the sense that it was a
No, we were told it was closed.
Oh, were you? I don't have the answer to that. I can ask and communicate through Brad. I'll ask the representative of the court that sets the meeting.
Because I'm just wondering how they get around that closed meetings act or whatever it is.
Yeah, there were no spectators there.
Yeah,
there was,
they wouldn't allow
there was a round table and each seat was filled. And
I was just kidding.
Appreciate that. You would check on it, Brad.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Okay. Courts and list cleanup. Kathy.
Okay, I have talked to Kim Allred, who is the court service director, about attending their next meeting, and so she's gonna send me the information so that I can start attending them. I've talked to Suzette a little bit about it, and also Brad about that, and so that's one of the things that I will start attending once I'm notified of that, so that we can still work on the fact that when you're talking about the exonerations, the prompt that they've got in place. I know that we're talking about from this point forward, but we're still talking about a lot of cleanup on the other side of it. So hopefully we can get something worked out that way so that it's a better list that I get from the courts when I'm looking at things. One of the things that I wanted to, the association has also mentioned, but Kim Allred had indicated that a lot of times with the undertaking of bonds, it's not everybody, but there are some that are putting the full Social Security number of the individual on the undertaking of bond. And you can put the last four digits of the Social Security number on it, but not the entire one. The identificator, or the identification number that they're talking about is just the last four digits of a Social Security number. And when she brings it to my attention, I do get a hold of the agency and say, you know, you've got to not do this because this is, their rules state that you cannot do it.
What about date of birth? Because I know some courts, like Cache County, want to put their date of birth on there, so.
I didn't see a problem. I don't remember her addressing that in the rules that I had received. It was more like your driver's license. It was, you know, your Social Security number. It was a couple other ones.
That is a little scary.
Yeah.
And do you know when that next meeting is going to be?
No, I left her another message this morning. They have had their meeting, I believe it was last month. So I am anticipating, I believe she said something about a bi-monthly meeting, so I'm anticipating something next month.
And in the past, as you traveled around to the different jails and the courts, you kind of did that one-on-one. This
yes.
will give you the venue
yes.
to talk to everybody at one time.
And yes, it will. And the other part is I know that they've actually added in their court procedure book about forfeitures and about how to send that information. So they are working with me on different aspects of it. So we're trying to make a better product.
Great.
Yeah.
We can fix it on the front end. It's a lot
yes,
easier.
Absolutely.
And I really appreciate all the effort you put into on your traveling expedition to work things out, because I think things have all, for every bond company, I think things are starting to work smoother because of the efforts you put forth.
Thank you. The other thing I want to mention is anytime I get a call and there's a concern about a list at a court or a specific court, I do actually get a hold of them and do the feedback. So that actually helps too. It keeps me up on if there's a problem in a certain jail or or if there's a problem in a certain court. So the feedback is needed both ways.
It's amazing how we can jump up and down and scream and yell or do whatever and get nowhere, and Kathy calls up and says, please, and the C parts and things work out.
It's a nice compliment. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. The next thing would be the National Bell Association meeting, and I would speak to that. And basically, all I was going to bring out is at that meeting, I talked to some different bell bondsmen around the country, and one in particular association stood out from Oklahoma.
Did you?
And there's Kathy's holding up a little pamphlet that she's got, and I would recommend that as an association, probably in conjunction with the association here and the department, we come up with some sort of a little quick reference guide when somebody gets a license that you can hand it to them. This does not override or in any way take away from the code book, but I think it's something that they can reference easily. We can give the codes that are applicable to different laws and problems. They can look at it quickly, give an explanation, and maybe even give a page reference in the code book if they want to read any farther. But I think it gives people a head start, and it gives people, just talking to Kathy, I know when she calls a lot of these companies, and she said, you know, you really need to do that. They really have no idea. Is it their responsibility to understand? Yes. Do all of them do it? No. And I think this would just give us a little bit of a head start. Like I said, it's a lot easier to help people conform than try to work on the back end.
Question. How does Oklahoma do it? Because I'm sure they're as automated as we are, and we don't see the licensee 99% of the time come in the office for any reason. And so how do they make these available, do you know?
Anybody that gets a new license.
How are they receiving them?
You know what, I would assume they mailed them out, and that would be a good question. I left the card on there to see. But anybody that to receive a new license, I would probably even, if possible, maybe we could put it on our website, make it available at our meetings, and we can make it available at the association meetings also. So we're open to suggestions, but I just think overall it would help.
And the only other question, I can see it twirling in Brett's head a little bit, I think, is our laws.
What? Sorry, I wasn't listening.
The statute changes, you know, we sometimes go 1 year where we don't change something.
Sometimes.
But, yeah. So you would be reprinting this every year, just so you know, that would be a cost to consider.
I agree. My thought is, I think it'd be worth it. On the back, how much would it help on one or two or three cases a month that you're dealing with? The time spent, I think, I can't speak to the department and any of their financial efforts, but I would think that would be tremendously easy. Brett, what do you think?
You know, this is a, you know, first impression for me. Mr. Chair, can we review it to the department and come and get back to the committee? I'd like to take a look at it. Obviously, we'll need two of us with the commissioner. If there is a financial commitment, I would imagine that the financial commitment would be limited if we really are just posting it on the website, other than a commitment of the resources the T has to judiciously manage. So can we take a look at it, learn a little bit more about it, and get back to the board?
Please do. And all it was just something, just like exactly as you said, something to look at, review. If we can glean any value from it, let's do it. If not, we try. But
I mean, electronically, I think it'd be very simple for us to do. But to produce and print these, it's...
And yeah. maybe what I was saying is, in conjunction with the two different entities, maybe you put it on the website, and as an association, if we can come together and agree on it, we could print it and make it available to our...
Is it just statutes in there?
Yeah,
or is
statute
it...
and rules. Yeah.
Okay, so there's no narrative, there's no... That's what is so time-consuming, is when we try and do a bulletin and really
exactly.
Get into examples.
And really...
Just a table of contents.
Yeah. really, we can do whatever.
So that could be cut and paste.
So I'll ask you a question too. How many new licensees do you have a year?
I could go through my list and
I just guess. I mean, hundreds or 50,
no,
25?
No.
Just a few, I would say.
Maybe 25 max.
So what if we don't produce it in a high gloss? I mean, if all, you know, I don't need Commissioner Doak's picture on ours. But,
whose picture would you like?
But I mean, if all we're doing is, if all you're doing is printing it and got what, about 50 pages, 43 pages. I mean, there's not a huge printing cost associated with this, and if there's only 25 or, you know, 30 people that we're talking about a year, I don't think that that's sort of an expensive department on a bit. Again, and that's not. If you want to go to a high gloss finish, I think we might choke a little bit. But if all you want is information that we give to a new licensee, mailing costs, it couldn't be that much money. But before we commit, we really would like to get at least a handle on how many sure we would be doing. And if it's just sections of code that we're putting in there, I think it would be really easy to produce.
We've got two
chapters that we have to. Unless I saw something that glaring at me that I don't see from right here, I would think that could be accomplished readily. But I don't think that if we could prevent.
That's it.
If we could prevent 5-10 people from appearing in this committee as a, you know, for a violation, I would applaud your efforts to try to get information out to people and educate them. So let's move forward to try to make that happen.
That's the whole goal here, I think.
Now,
the department, the board, the industry, we would rather have the knowledge out there where we don't ever have to get to complaints and forfeitures and penalties and fines. Let's get it taken care of right up front.
You'd think it'd be something useful for the jails and the courts.
Well, exactly.
I don't know necessarily it would be advantageous for the jail because we're just, you know, we just collect paper. You know, we expect the bondsmen to know what they're doing. If they're on the list, we take their bond.
Well, I think there are certain parts of the code, like what is allowed for advertising and different things that Kathy deals with in the jail.
Right.
So all that
maybe
would not apply to a jail. But one or two pages would.
Might.
And so maybe you wouldn't give the whole book to the jail, but maybe you could get a different little leaflet or something.
Maybe
it was laminated.
Kathy keeps us pretty straight and narrow on that stuff.
She does. But she has to do that
right.
Person from jail to jail, and it hasn't happened until Kathy started making her rounds.
Yep.
And even then, I'm going to speak about me and speak to myself, but my memory's not that good, and you remember it one day, and if you don't do it for a while, all of a sudden you say, now, what did you say? And if you've got that guy, nope, they can't put business cards on the counter, and just different things. I don't think it would hurt. I think a lot of our problems aren't people trying to circumvent the law. It's lack of understanding or forgetting or something like that.
Chairman, may I ask a question?
Yes, Steve.
I'm just wondering, it seems to me like this knowledge would be better placed on the front end of the license. What kind of knowledge-based procedures do we have in place prior to obtaining the license? So that when we give a license to these, you know, a 16-year-old driver, we say we know he's not going to just go run amok on the road, that he actually knows what he's doing as a bondsman or surety. Are there any? Do we have?
There's 2,000-hour requirement.
I'm sorry?
To get an agency license.
To get an
if
agency
you're talking
license.
About a limited line producer license, all you have to do is go in to the authorized center, pay your money for your license, get fingerprinted, fill out your application, and that's it.
That's it. So I think
the agency that agent writes for is going to be the one that answers to all of their. So it's the agency's responsibility up to this point to make sure that you're an agency.
Right, in order to do any, as Clay said, in order to do any work as in the bonding industry. They have to be associated to an agency. And it does talk about in the code book that any of the acts of an agent are the acts of the agency. So
the knowledge required to use that license, I guess, comes, this is a responsibility of the agency.
Yes.
And in order to become an agency, do we have any of that kind of information or knowledge requirements for them?
You do have to have 2,000 hours of experience in the Belmont industry before you can become an agency. So,
but as far as, as far as knowledge of the law itself, I mean, because I think we could say there's a lot of agencies out there that they may have been doing this 200 or 2,000 hours the wrong way. And so, I mean, it seems like, you know, with our driver's license, we have to take at least a basic test, and things to make sure that we understand what we're doing out there. It seems to me that maybe this, I mean, yes, this now for the to check the symptoms, but maybe in the future, you might want to look at the licensing process or the agency.
So you suggest maybe having a test that they have to pass prior to getting a license?
Or at least have someone on there who has been certified as having some sort of knowledge. Because that's what I thought, at least as a prosecutor. People just don't know the statutes. Like, you're right. Sometimes they're not trying to circumvent, but they're not trying to find it out either.
Exactly. And it doesn't make a difference whether they're trying or whether they just don't know or just don't care. The result's the same. So anything we can do to educate them right up front, I wouldn't be opposed to a test.
Stephen, your point is, I think, very good. What we need to educate and help people learn. And I thought something earlier when I was looking at the report. We list the name of people who have had actions against them, but we don't list the agency that they're licensed with, which made me just ask the question, do we have certain agencies that have more bad actors than others, and do we need to spend some time helping people understand the code a little bit better? And I don't know if that's something that our department has looked at, but you know, if we have a frequency issue, it might be good for the department to sit down with the owners of the agency and say, hey, we're seeing a trend here. I don't know if you picked that up or not in your investigations, Kathy, but maybe something to look at too in terms of not that we want to go find somebody as much as we want to, you know, educate and help them understand, you know, problems that are occurring. So.
Yeah, but we don't actually see the names of the agencies. So,
or the individuals.
We don't see any of that.
Just the new licensees.
Yes, the new licensees.
Was that all we see in that report?
Yes.
Everything else is a number?
Yes. Yep. You guys see that on the back end. On the front end, we don't see that. And so
we would know. Do you know? You see that?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. Of course we know.
We hope
when you pay attention. You pay attention. You see trends at all.
And that's why we've added that added page right there that says, yes, they know their actions.
Uh-huh.
And we've added that both in this setting and in another setting because it will show you that they're repeat offenders and whether those are similar things that are going on.
That was a new request that the board made, and Kathy, you were there.
Very good point.
But I do think that pamphlet, at least for treatment symptoms right now, is great.
And like I said, I don't think all the things together, I think, would make it a lot better. One helps, test would help, maybe all of them, three-pronged approach, test at the beginning, a pamphlet to help during, and if people are having a hard time staying in the dotted lines, maybe a phone call and
a nudge.
Yeah.
That a little nudge Catherine's rather picture than on the back of it.
a little nudge rather than a big nudge from the commissioner. I mean, I think that's the ultimate goal, is just to get everybody to conform.
It is, absolutely.
Is there any other questions or comments? Okay, that is all of the new business. The old business, I think you've already
Yeah, I don't know what else.
I don't know if it would need to be.
There was a bill, but it didn't make it passed. It made it through the House, but not the Senate.
Overwhelmingly.
Yeah, Kathy was there. The commissioner was there as long as he had two committees he was juggling. I was sitting over in the in my office. It came up at like 7:30 at night, listening in the House, and then it stalled in the Senate, I guess. Certainly good good support from Representative Hutchinson. He was pretty aggressive.
We learned who our friends were and who our adversary was. Anyway, if there's no other questions about that, is there anything else that needs to be brought up?
Motion to adjourn.
What was the mental health treatment?
You know, that's something that we put on there in case anyone wants to speak to it. It's an idea that's come up. It's almost like a pretrial release type of thing. I'm not an expert on it, but the concept is to release somebody that's been arrested for maybe a drug offense into a counseling or addiction treatment plan, and to, in order, one of the requirements to move into a substance abuse type treatment plan, to allow them to post a bail bond to ensure that they complete it and or come back to court. And it's something that was discussed during the legislative session, but there was nothing, no law was passed on that issue. So really the idea is, could you use a bail bond or the type of bond that is issued by members of this committee to integrate into such a substance abuse treatment program?
Just to oversee and make sure that the defendant did perform their court-ordered duties and reported back to the judge.
Okay, so it would be a little bit more involved, I guess, than just a performance bond that they'll appear, but they have some affirmative obligations to check progress and make reports.
Wait.
The idea is we're appearance people. We can get people to go to where they, to the appointments they need to be. So as the state is trying to find alternatives to incarcerating people and trying to find forms to release them and still allow them treatment, the bail bond industry would like to be an integral part of that. And we figured we could be a part of getting people to the treatment programs and still able to get out of jail.
Without any additional cost to the state.
Lots
it's
of,
a self-payer
lots of
system.
Details. Exactly. That was the
difference
that
I've
been coined as a treatment bond.
So it's just something I've thought of. No one else has
so
heard of that to bring it up.
It puts the bondsman in a supervising type role,
capacity.
Like a probation officer or a.
Potentially.
Potentially.
And it would be separate than
as much as we are today.
Right.
But if Schwimmer has his way, none of us will be here next year anyway, so.
There'll be three of us.
So is that a risk that you guys would like to? I'm just kind of curious.
It's one of those things that have been thrown out there. Are we interested in looking at it? Yes. We couldn't make or give you a definite answer until we had all the details in front of us.
Well, yeah, what is
you're taking on a huge task.
It is.
It's one thing to get somebody to show up for court, but it's another. Being a former drug court trafficker, I mean, it's just like that. It's wow.
And that's what they were thinking, is that's why we need the bondsman to do it, because it is such an overwhelming job and a huge expense to the state.
You take a huge liability, too, as far as search
exactly,
procedure.
Yeah.
And, wow.
Amen. That's good feedback.
So how many meetings would they be required to go to?
That would be up to, that's what I said, this has only
been
talked
about.
It all depends on.
I would guess probably maybe six.
It all depends on how they're assessed in their initial assessment for the drug treatment. Whether it's intensive, outpatient, inpatient, there's all different levels that go
let's
into
it. Let's not forget the most important part. This is all taxpayer free. This is a user payer system. It doesn't burden the taxpayer to release them and make sure that they're monitored in and all that sort of thing. That's the real value of the bail bond system, the courts and all that.
Well, it's just like the ankle monitoring business. I mean, we have people who place ankle monitors, private businesses who put ankle monitors on to ensure where they're off. So I can see it kind of being similar to that.
And it might even be in conjunction with. Yeah. The model that they were talking about was like a 6 month. Every 30 days they would have to do something.
Or
but again, it varies from every judge. There is nothing that's going to be in stone. Everybody looks at it.
So instead of spending more time in jail, they're released and you're kind of monitoring them.
Rehabilitate, get them out of the jails.
Get them out of the jails.
And the state will do this for about 4 years and then go back to the system that we're at, just like they did with ECR. It's always a learning process.
Basically. Well, we all know the jails are overcrowded. It's very, very expensive to house them. And if recidivism wasn't so high, you know, I think we would be way more optimistic about it. But we don't seem to have a very good program in our to rehabilitate them and get them back into society. I don't know where it is and why it is we fail there, but if recidivism wasn't so high, this type of thing, I think, would be wonderful. If we could somehow matriculate them back into the job market and get them to work, and I don't know if it's, I mean, I've never worked in this system, I don't know it, but it would seem to me that we ought to spend more time trying to figure that one out than how we matriculate a potential convict felon back into the work environment. Maybe they're just personalities. Maybe it's something that's innate in their brain that says.
You can figure that out. You will be a rich man.
I have a follow-up question. So, I'm on another committee with the AG's HIPAA task force, where they, you know, the jails and the prisons are always trying to figure out how to pay for health care, because once they're incarcerated, they're responsible. The jail or the county or the city, wherever they're incarcerated, is responsible for the health care. So, and as part of that, to my understanding, is something like. Over 90% of individuals that are incarcerated do not have private health insurance.
Correct.
So in the drug court, in your experience, who pays for the treatment? Is it a state-based program? Is it
the sliding scale?
Sliding scale, okay. So that wouldn't be, it wouldn't be only available to those that have the
means, right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then each county's health department has supplied some funds. For that, a lot of monies that come from DUI citations, those kinds of things, are funded back into those programs as well.
Let's see.
Those charges.
All it was they asked us, could you guys be a part of this new system that's trying to be developed? We said we would be interested in taking a look at it.
Well, from my perspective, I didn't get a chance to say, nor was I asked, but I will say thank you for your service to this. What you bring in perspective that you have, I appreciate that. Thank you for the discussion.
I appreciate everybody here. Thanks for coming. Thank you, Commissioner. Meeting adjourned.
See you in the corner.
Hey, Brad.
Commissioner. A quick second.
Whoops, David.
That's just
fine.
Thank you.
So,
see you again. I'll be here.
So, there's some legislation. I don't see where we're going. The Attorney General's office is available on board. There was, I guess, some communication last year, some assumptions made on both our parts that might be included in the House Department bill. It wasn't. And it was supposed to be a communication. We have something that I think, well, I don't know if this is correct.